KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint. K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove. KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay. KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass. And KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
Programming on KSDP is supported by the Schumigan Corporation. Located in Sandpoint, the Schumigan family of businesses includes property and equity management, the Sandpoint Tavern, the Anchor Inn Motel, and the Anchor Inn Lounge. The Schumigan Corporation, serving its shareholders and the people of Sandpoint, on the web at www.schumigan.com or by telephone at 907-383-3525. The Schumigan Corporation, hometown values and service, a proud sponsor of KSDP.
You know, I've seen guys like you in here before. You're not the only lonely one.
It's a junked out joint off a back road, a blinking window sign with an arrow, a gravel lot chock full of toolbox trucks, making their happy hour way home. When guys like me lose girls like you, that's where we run to. They got Whiskey River on the jukebox, a honky tonk sawdust dance floor, a neon 5 o'clock road clock, and plenty damn many when you want more. This broke heart fool on an old bar stool, drinking beer almost as cold as. Good time numbers on the stall door, a picture of you on the dartboard. Them cinder block walls ain't ever been clean, still ain't as dirty as you done me. Whiskey River on the jukebox, a honky tonk sawdust dance floor, a neon 5 o'clock road clock, and plenty damn many when you want more. This broke heart fool on an old bar stool, drinking beer like me, lose girls like you, that's where we run to. We got Whiskey River on the jukebox, a honky tonk sawdust dance floor, a neon 5 o'clock road clock, and plenty damn many when you want one more. This broke heart fool on an old bar stool, drinking beer almost as cold as you.
I'm missing your love. If you wake up When I die, I want to come back as a country boy. No, there ain't no better life if you ask me. If my neck don't come out red, then Lord, just keep me dead. 'Cause a country boy's all that I know how to be. My back is always breaking. My dogs are always barking. My money has trouble making, and my truck has trouble starting. I'm up before the sun, either hauling hay or hunting. My work ain't ever done, but son, I wouldn't trade it for nothing. So when I die, I wanna come back as a country boy. Country boy's all that I know how to be. Yeah, if y'all ain't in the draw and a fish ain't on my wall and the whiskey don't burn going down, my feet ain't in a holler and blue ain't on my collar, leave my hand cranking beer, drinking ice in the ground. Yeah, when I die, I want to come back as a country boy. Country boy's all that I know how to be. When I die, I want to come back as a country boy, live on this land like my old man did before.
This is Dmitry Filimonov, President and CEO of the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association.
Over the last 5 years, APIA's Tribal Child Support Program has collected and distributed nearly $1.5 million, with 100% of those funds going to parents raising our next generation. We offer flexible and holistic case management to families. All residents of the Regional 10 communities are eligible for this alternative to state child support. To apply, please go to apiai.org or call 1-800-478-2742.
Remember, if you are in Anchorage, please come visit the Unangamulla, home of the Aleuts. Unangam, Atakan, Akun. We are one.
This message brought to you by the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association.
Supporting public radio is a great way to reach your customers in Southwest Alaska. 8:30 a.m. KSDP and its partner station, 88.1 FM K201DA, provide the only available radio service to the Aleutians East Borough and beyond. From Perryville and Nelson Lagoon to Cold Bay, King Cove, and Sandpoint, KSDP serves its listeners with 24 hours a day news, talk, and music programming. For corporate sponsorship opportunities, contact KSDP at 907-303-5737 or visit ksdpradio.com. Become a part of Team KSDP today. KSDP and our corporate partners committed to radio service in Southwest Alaska.
This program was brought to you by Jim and Shirley Brown's Apartments, located in Sandpoint above Trident Seafoods and the Boat Harbor, featuring two-bedroom apartments on a month-to-month basis. For more information, call Jim Brown at 386-6050.
KSDP, 830 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
I'm a paleo nut, I'm a paleo nut, I'm a paleo nut, don't you understand? I'm a paleo nut.
Hey, Ray! Paleo.
Hello, David.
How you doing?
I'm doing good, relatively.
Oh, relatively. What do you mean?
Well, I'm a little raspy. My better half, Michelle, has a little touch of something. And yeah, we're hoping it's not the thing.
You sound perfectly normal to me.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
So
how are you doing?
I'm good. Yeah. I'm in Ojai, where it was 107 degrees yesterday, according to my analog temperature gauge. Yeah.
107.
107, correct.
Wow. Well,
and you're in Ketchikan, where it's a balmy 65.
65-ish today, which is a great day. And the humpies are in the creek, and there's already been a showdown with a bear in my driveway.
Really? Wait, humpies? Yeah. I thought humpies are like the last salmon run. I'm so confused.
Well, yeah, well, they're showing up. It's the end of July.
They're in September.
No, those are cohos coming in September, late August. But the humpies, it's their turn. The kings have had their day.
Right.
Kings are first, as they are, should be.
Right.
And now there are pink salmon jumping in the Haba, making their way up to their final resting place.
Is that a Brooklyn accent?
Yeah, it was a little Haba there,
Yeah. Haba. Oh, Haba. So, oh, Boston. Yeah, Haba.
Haba. Right. In the Haba. So
right.
I'm from back east, So,
right.
Hey.
So fantastic paleontological news.
Rocking my world, man. I heard about it through the grapevine and it's like, what? Tell them, Dave. Tell them.
First of all, there was one of the greatest discoveries is the fighting dinosaurs, which wasn't that a baby T-Rex or a smaller T-Rex?
No. It was a Protoceratops and a velociraptor.
And a velociraptor.
Locked in mortal combat from Mongolia.
Right. So they figured
that was
very
famous.
Buried in a sand dune or something like that. And they're literally locked in time, as our previous guest, Dee Lomax, would say.
Yeah.
And so this latest find, which is funny, it was discovered in 2012, and it took all this time to prepare and describe it. 11 years later,
that is crazy. It's a Psittacosaurus being attacked by a mammal, a badger-like mammal called Rapanomammus robustus.
Yeah, and the cool part is that the Rapanomammus is biting the ribs of the Psittacosaurus.
Yeah,
and his hand is wrapped around the lower jaw of the beak of the Psittacosaurus.
You can say it, Dave. Psittacosaurus.
Psittacosaurus.
It's a silent P.
It's kind of like a ceratopsian. It's like a relative of the Triceratops, right?
Yes. Yeah. Ceratopsian. Early Ceratopsian.
And so this Rapanomammus is what? Like a mole or what?
No, it's badger size.
Oh, badger
size. It's badger size. It's a badger. So, like a wolverine will sometimes take down like a caribou. It's known to happen.
Sure.
So this is a smaller animal. There might have been a pack of them.
Oh.
Think about them as like wild dogs taking down a big zebra or something
Never
like that.
Never thought of that.
So, a whole little pack of these Rapanomammuses, attacking the... Sattacking, or I should, well, I couldn't help myself.
Sattacking.
Sattacking. The Psittacosaurus and taking it down. And we talked about Psittacosaurus on a previous episode with Tom Kay, your pal.
Oh, right.
And that's where they have such, they put the laser lights on it, you know, on the fossil, and they could see the feathery tail and actually even the color pattern on the animal. So they're able to figure out the color of this Attackosaurus. So now this badger-like mammal attacking one is pretty spectacular. It's from China. I guess it's going to stay in China. Took 11 years to study it. They wanted to make sure everything was right, but I guess it was buried in a volcanic mud flow, like instantaneous.
Pompeii style.
Yeah.
So my question is, this is like a moment in time. How do you know they weren't like friends and just having a friendly wrestle?
Well, I'm sure the scientists went through every scenario they could. And
yeah,
so
they did. They said there were no bite marks on it, so it wasn't scavenging.
Yeah. Didn't die just like nearby and get buried on top. It is literally wrapped around the dinosaurs.
We will have links to this in this episode's show notes at paleonerds.com.
It just kind of goes against the whole story that we've always, thought about, is that, dinosaurs died out and then the mammals took off, so dinosaurs, their reign, the terrestrial dinosaurs, their reign ends at 66 million years ago, and then the mammals really start to flourish. Well, that is the case, but it's not like the mammals were just sitting around being
cowering
in the shadow of big dinosaurs. They were in the game.
Badass, man.
Yeah, man, they were badass. Badass badgers.
I feel a little better now that our mammals kind of were fighting back.
That's true. Maybe, we could think of it more like a raccoon. So from Guardians of the Galaxy or something, raccoons taking on the Cetacosauruses. So anyways, cool story. So remarkable. And that is the cool thing about the fossil record. You never know what's going to be found next.
And
man,
that also leads to the idea that there could be 20 other fossils like this in preparation right now that we won't know about for another 10 years.
Yeah, there might be somebody listening to the show like going, I'll wait till this one springs out there.
That's right. So our guest today is someone that you were like, oh, he's an artist and I love him. I'm like, oh, come on, Ray, not another artist. And then I was like, oh, my God. Not only did I just was blown away by his work, but I realized it was his art that inspired me to partly go deep dive down into paleontology, because it was the cover art that he did of Dinosaur Heresies, the Robert Bakker. There it is right there. In fact, I'll hold it up too. There it is. Tell us about who this gentleman is and let's get him on the phone.
Well, the thing is that John Gerchy is our guest, and I've known him for almost 30 years, I guess, but I knew about his stuff. But yeah, he's been kind of, in the background for a lot of people, but his art is just so riveting. When you see it, it's like, but I'm the kind of guy like, who did that? So I drilled down on that. Then I was lucky enough to meet him at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science back in 99 or thereabouts, and then a few times since then. And he is a major artist. He's a scientist, too. I would argue that he is a scientist. He completely blurs the line between art and science. He's known for his dinosaur art, and he influenced.
Well, he had four stamps with the U.S. Postal Service.
Four stamps, and he was an advisor on Jurassic Park, the first film.
What's that?
Well, it's this little movie that came out a little while back, and some of his paintings were so iconic that Spielberg noticed them, and one of them was of a raptor taking down an iguanodont, a group of raptors. So that helped. He's just, like I said, been a huge influence. But then he took a big turn into studying human origins.
Right.
And
our
hominins.
Hominins.
Can you hominin? I'm stretching.
Stop. Let's just get him on the phone and let's
call
talk
him on the
to John.
I'm going on about it. John Gerchy, the man, the human.
Yeah.
So call him up, man.
Okay.
So excited.
Here we go.
Hey, Dave, meet John Gerchy, the artist in residence at the Paleontological Research Institution. He is one of the world's leading paleo artists, especially of early hominins. John is a sculptor, a painter, a draftsman extraordinaire, and an author, and also a man who blurs the line between science and art. Hey, John, is that a good description of you?
Well, it's great, except for that last sentence.
So what's the deal with the last sentence?
Well, there's something that bothers me about blurring the line, because I do both art and science, but I have to be very clear about which I'm doing at any moment in time.
Ah.
So, for example, somebody who approaches the same subject, let's say they're reconstructing human ancestors, is just an artist and doesn't know much about anatomy, might do a complete artist's impression, basically. I try not to do that. There are definitely some parts of the reconstruction of an early hominin that will be speculative, but I try to do it as much as possible by the numbers. And I try to be very aware when I'm straying into the territory of just art.
Well, you know, now that you put it that way, I guess I'm the guy that blurs the lines. you know which lane to stay in. And I'm just all over the place. But, you know.
Well, it's two different styles of art.
Yeah, two different styles. I'm a scientific surrealist because I let that art just creep in all the time. And then, no, I try to be exact. And then I get a little crazy. But I totally hear what you're saying. But I think Dave has a very important question to ask you.
Yeah,
sure.
And I'm going to get into your realism, which is I'm a fan of photorealistic art. But John, are you a paleo nerd?
Well, I'm not sure what you need to qualify to join that club.
Did you draw dinosaurs as a kid?
Yes.
Okay.
He's a nerd.
You're a nerd. So you're one of those guys. I was a dinosaur nerd from day one. And it's interesting, you and I overlap in a number of ways. And one of them is, where are you from, John? I just want to get a little bit into your background, and then we'll dive into the
and how you started.
Yeah. Tell me, where are you from?
I grew up in a suburb of Kansas City. This was on the Kansas side, but it wasn't really close to Kansas City. Wasn't Kansas City, Kansas so much as a southern suburb. And the great thing about it, about growing up there, was that everything south of us, and I mean everything south of our house, was woods or farmland or lakes or rivers. And I could just, with my brother, ride my bike out into the country and have all these adventures. And that included a lot of exposure to the natural world, both living critters, but also there were fossils everywhere in stream beds and road cuts. So I was...
Western Interior Seaway fossils? Marine?
No, these are earlier. These are Carboniferous.
Paleozoic stuff. So I have some overlap in Kansas as well. So I went to high school and junior high school there. And you ended up going to the University of Kansas in Lawrence.
That's right. Yeah.
And you were a geology major. And then you did a master's in anthropology?
Yeah, that's right. Biological anthropology.
Well, what's kind of mind-blowing is that I was reading your book, and I was going through this, The Lost Anatomies, and you thank three people. You thank Stanley Kubrick, this guy named Larry Martin, and
These are inspirational thank yous, right?
Yes, inspirational thank yous, and Lauren Isley. And I was like, wait a minute, Larry Martin? I had some time with Larry Martin.
So when did you overlap with Larry Martin?
Larry Martin was the very first paleontologist I ever met, and he critiqued my art, and it was a really mind-blowing. He was very kind to me, and I was just stunned that, like, wow, Larry Martin is one of the three big
influences. He was the one that said, don't quit your day job. Was that the guy?
Yeah.
Well, when would that have been?
We may have crossed paths. Well, I was in high school in 72, but it was probably 1971. I ended up doing a summer semester at Lawrence in theater.
So where were you in 71, 72 when Ray was meeting Mr.
Martin?
Oh, I was
at KU. I was there. Yeah. In fact, I remember passing you in the street, Ray. I don't think you looked as old as you do now.
Anyways, we crossed paths at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science, but you had some time. Larry set you on a path, I guess, of some sort.
That's right. Yeah, he was a really great teacher. And I appreciated that. He was so enthusiastic. You know, hold up these skulls of saber-toothed cats and almost jump around the room with them. He was so excited. So that was really infectious, and I was grateful.
Kubrick. Now, I'm a fan of Kubrick. He is the quintessential cinematographer. What is it about Kubrick's work that inspired you in paleontology?
Everything.
2001 well, okay. A Space Odyssey. That is my favorite opening scene to any film ever. I've seen it 50, 60 times.
Me too. I would say the same. I'll just tell you a little history and culminate with my exposure to Kubrick. So when I was a kid, you know, I was interested in anatomy. My parents say that I found a mouse skeleton under their bushes and I was trying to put it back together in my 4-year-old way. And
really?
And there were fossils all over the place. I was fascinated by these intricate little patterns that could occur inside of a rock.
Yeah.
That was so exciting to me. And so I started collecting fossils and I started building skeletons of animals and basically got really interested in the history of life, the evolution of life. And so at a pretty young age, I started this project to make an evolutionary tree of all life. And I had a motley assortment of books to inform me. I had some of my uncle's old college textbooks. I had some books by Romer, the paleontologist.
Oh, wow. Right.
I had some books that almost treated a series of living forms as if they were an evolutionary sequence, which is kind of a bogus thing to do. But I included that in there. I didn't know how to really tell the difference. So anyway, I had this project about the history of life. And then I got to be a teenager. Those things subsided a little bit. And
well, there's this distraction that happens. Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Cars and girls.
When you did this big family tree project, you were in middle school and you did little clay sculptures, is what I read somewhere?
I was in various science fairs in grade school doing little clay sculptures.
Oh. And, of what?
Well, one project was the evolution of turtles. And the next project was more ambitious. It was the evolution of vertebrates from... but you know... I again was
so guilty cool.
of I was using living forms as evolution as part of an evolutionary sequence from Amphioxus to humans.
Wow, it's a big project.
It is. Where I could, I had actual specimens and skeletons, and where I didn't have those, I built clay models of skeletons, and so wow. I went all the way through. Didn't win a blue ribbon for that one. I think they thought I had too much help from an adult or something. But anyway, studied wow. all that stuff and was really excited about that. And then I became a teenager and there was, girls and
rock and roll.
Also rock and roll. And I started playing drums in a band.
That's right. You're a musician as well.
Yep. And I started painting psychedelic posters. This was the 60s.
Really? I saw that. Do you have any of those posters still, John?
I do.
Man, I would love to see those because I knew that was in your DNA too, man.
Were they black light posters?
Well, people don't realize this about Kansas, and especially Lawrence, Kansas, man. Lawrence, Kansas, you know, I was in Wichita and stuff, and then I went to this little school up in Lindsborg, but Lawrence was always the hippie paradise of the
really?
Midwest.
And you wouldn't think that.
Yeah, no, you would never think that William Burroughs
San Francisco,
ended up
New York.
Spending his yeah. last years there. It was like a totally hip, just crazy place. And there were psychedelic bands and the police were a big presence there. But man, it was the hippie capital. And I went to every kind of concert up there, John. You and I were probably at a lot of the same concerts during those years. But
so how did you go from yeah. being a teenager to getting on the cover of one of the most iconic paleontological books by Robert Bacher? It was this picture, by the way. I'm holding it up, and I'll have a link in our Paleo Nerds episode on you, John. But I found a group of postcards of your art in the 80s, and each card showed dinosaurs with the dappled sunlight in the forest and kicking up dust and in motion. And it was your art that inspired me to dive into paleontology.
Oh, that's so great to hear. I love
it's
hearing
true.
That.
Well, John, you've been such a huge force in the paleo science world, and your paintings are stunning. They are visions of the past, and the detail is extraordinary, hyper-realistic.
It's photorealism, yeah.
Yeah, photorealism for the past. And so you don't how'd you get so good as an artist while you're over there in the science department? Were you hanging out in the art department too, or what?
Well, no, but I have to back up because I only told the story as far as teenagehood.
And right. Then I didn't... Okay. There's the transition. That's what we're asking. Yeah.
Right. So I was a teenager interested in the usual teenage things. And my obsession with the history of life, the evolution of life, really sort of began to fade and take a back seat until the moment I saw 2001, A Space Odyssey. And that movie, I mean, I'm almost embarrassed to admit how much influence that movie had over me, but that movie said so eloquently a few things that hadn't occurred to me. And one of them was basically just what a bizarre development in the history of life on Earth the evolution of human consciousness is, or was, is, we hope.
Yeah, yeah.
That really hadn't occurred to me in the way that it was presented in that movie. And I was just stunned. And suddenly, when I came out of that movie, I knew basically two things. I knew I had to study human origins.
Wow.
Because I realized all this evolutionary stuff I'd been studying applied to this miraculous creature, which was us. So the other thing I knew was that I had to work as an artist. And as I said, I was already painting psychedelic posters and so forth. So I started that summer, the summer after I saw that movie, I started my first human evolution mural in my parents' basement on a long piece of butcher paper. That summer, I think my parents must have thought I was a bum. I failed to find a job at the beginning of the summer. I walked around barefoot all the time, throwing a bone up in the air and
watching it turn into a satellite.
Watching it spin against the sky, hoping it would turn into a satellite.
Wow.
The black slab.
Yeah. That was really a formative summer for me. I started reading everything I could on human origins and painting a lot of stuff, drawing a lot of stuff that had to do with hominins. But, you know, so I knew that I wanted to work in paleo art. And when I was in graduate school studying biological anthropology, I took a trip around the country. That was to study. I did my master's thesis on early primate brain evolution.
Wow.
So I traveled around the country to study fossils in various museums. And each time I would get to a museum, I would also stop in and show my art to the exhibits department. So I did that at the Smithsonian, the American Museum, the Yale Peabody. I think I also did it at a museum in Texas, but that didn't amount to anything. but anyway, so I showed these people my art, and it apparently piqued their interest, because not long after that, when I'd finished my master's degree and I had taken over one of my courses for my advisor who was on sabbatical, I got a call from the Smithsonian and they asked me to bid on a project.
Really?
Yeah. And so I was all set to go. Which, actually, I should say, it was kind of surprising looking back, because the art that I showed them was this trippy, weird stuff.
Yeah, I was wondering, were these the psychedelic posters of,
Yeah, they kind of were. I mean, there was a face in the stars, a tree with eyes.
Cosmic, mind-blowing hippie stuff, man.
Yeah, but they must have been anatomically correct for the Smithsonian to take notice.
Well, not really.
but it's the science that's driving you around. So that's really this confluence of the art and science and which lane to be in. But it was the science that was taking you to these museums, like, oh, by the way, I've got this art. And some of these scientists via the exhibits department.
Well, what was the bid? What was the Smithsonian
project? Yeah, what was project? That project? Yeah.
That was a project doing a mural to back up a diorama, and it was a Devonian scene, so it was about the transition to land. Before I even knew that I got that job, I worked all summer painting houses and making little money. At the end of the summer, I moved to D.C. I hadn't gotten the job yet. I was just determined to make it work. I had $500 in my pocket and a broken-down Volkswagen. I moved to D.C. and got the cheapest rental I could and starved for a little while I waited for them to decide whether my bid would be accepted. And it was. Wow. And so that kind of started my time at the Smithsonian.
Wow.
Of course, I painted it on site. And that was important because I met so many of the curators and scientists and so forth at the Smithsonian, and of course got to know the exhibits people well. That led to the second job there, which was the Tower of Time.
The Tower of Time, an awesome painting.
I don't know that.
It's a really cool painting. And
is it like the solar system origins to the present?
Kinda, John.
It was the first cell to the present.
Right.
And
right.
It was, you know, to put it in perspective, if I had done the whole history of life, there would have been 7 more time columns underneath it.
Right.
Towers of Time. But I started with the first cell and the first, I had a Volvox in there as a colonial form.
Right.
And then it was, you know, it went all the way to the top, 30 feet above.
Yes, 30 feet. It goes through a couple floors.
And was there a man on the moon like they have in the Griffith Observatory? They have something very similar.
Oh, yeah. No man on the moon, except at the top there are 3 modern faces and also the Earth. And that's kind of the very top.
As a scorched remnant of humanity. We all died out.
It wasn't quite scorching yet. It was starting, maybe.
I just had a quick question, John, as an aside here. Did you meet Jay Maternus or interact with Jay
then
when you were at the Smithsonian?
Yeah, and that story is kind of funny. I don't know if you want to hear it.
We just interviewed him a couple of episodes ago.
You talked to him?
Yeah, we did a great interview with Jay and shared a lot of his art, and people just went nuts for it. And
when I first got that bid from the Smithsonian, I wrote Jay Maternus, and I was trying to figure out how this all works. You know, can you actually make a life doing this, et cetera? And I didn't hear back. I moved to D.C. And then I was talking to my mother on the phone, and she said, "Oh, you've got a letter from a Jay Maternus." And I said,
"No way.
Oh, wow." He finally wrote back. So she opened it and read it to me. And it was the most discouraging letter.
What?
I could have imagined.
No.
Yeah. Get a real job.
Yeah. It was like, you can't make a living doing this. Don't even try, etc. And you know, all I could say was, I'm glad I didn't get that, you know, before I left, because by that time I was neck deep in it, you know. And then a couple of years later, I heard that Jay was coming in to dissect an orangutan, and I really wanted to be part of that. And I tried to talk him into letting me do the face. He had to do it fairly quickly, because the people wanted the space in the freezer at the Smithsonian. And so, no, he didn't let me do the face, but I got to kind of help out and hold the arms out while he was cutting into them and so forth.
Does that take place in a cold room? Does it have to be cold?
Let's see. I'm trying to remember whether this one was in formalin or not. I can't remember. But
so
I don't remember the room being cold.
It's in some sort of formaldehyde. It's in a preservative.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think
wow.
So. Then we all went to lunch, and everybody was talking as we went around the table. Everybody was talking about just kind of introducing themselves and talking about what they were into, what they were doing. So when it got to me, I said, "I'm trying to do what he does," pointing to Jay. And he immediately launched into almost the same speech that was in the letter.
It's tough, kid. You're not going to make it.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, you know, he set the bar up there, but yeah.
But I really admire his work a lot, and the fact that he does a lot of dissection, which I later did. I tried to take it a little farther than he did with really intricate facial dissections of all species of great apes and humans.
Your art on dinosaurs is prolific. I mean, I've seen so many fantastic illustrations and paintings, but why the switch from dinosaurs to hominins?
Yeah.
It seems like your career took a right turn. And that's what you were originally interested in.
That's what I was originally interested in. But hominin work wasn't really available when I mean, Jay Maternus was right in a way. It wasn't really available when I got to D.C. The Smithsonian wasn't doing anything on human origins. And when I approached National Geographic and many other doors, they would say, "Well, oh, we use Jay Maternus for that." And so... So I couldn't really get in the door. I mean, I would have done hominins initially right off the bat. So I had to bide my time and do dinosaurs. And I love dinosaurs. I love going to the Mesozoic. It's like an exotic vacation going to the Mesozoic. I don't consider myself an expert, but I do listen to the experts. Each of those paintings is heavily informed by talking with experts and getting their take on exactly the behaviors I was illustrating and the, you know, basically the anatomy and the.
But your use of light is phenomenal.
Yeah, I'm just curious, John. Thanks. When you do a painting, and I'd heard this anecdotally, maybe via Gary Staub or someone like that, that you, to get that lighting that Dave's alluding to, is that you would actually build sort of small sculptures and light them so that you could really study what was happening?
It's Vermeer-like.
Well, thank you. And that is what I do. And there's kind of a funny story associated with that Bacher cover. You want to hear that?
Yeah.
Okay. So I had made models of the two dinosaurs, which were Diplodocus and Styracosaurus. And I wanted to kick up some dust and photograph them with all this dust flying around.
Yeah.
And so I went down into my basement with an air compressor and a bunch of dust that I had gathered from a baseball diamond.
Wow.
And it was very hot. So I took off everything except for my underwear. And then a friend of mine came over and knocked on the door, but I couldn't hear him. So he came into the house and eventually came down the stairs, and there was all this dust flying around and this guy in his underwear blowing dust all over these dinosaurs and photographing it. And that was my preparation for that piece.
Well, it was successful because an amazing, amazing painting. Is that done in acrylics?
Acrylic paint?
Yes.
And you actually, some of these are, you know, I've looked at the dimensions, are pretty small paintings you meticulously paint. But then if you're using acrylic and you're talking about that dust, how do you paint dust in acrylics?
Yeah, very carefully.
Looks like airbrush.
Yeah, those paintings take a while to do. And so I'm doing these constant little washes to add up to that dust, and very subtle washes. And then I go over it again, and then I go over it again.
Washes, I'm guessing, a lot of water and a little pigment.
Yeah, that's right.
It's sort of like glazing in oil paints. So it's a similar kind of thing where you build it up. Well, cool. Shall we veer into our human origins? Because
sure.
Well, your sculptures are in the Smithsonian, in the Hall of Time. And
Hall of Human Origins, actually.
Oh, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Now, your hominin sculptures are your best guess of the most accurate representation of not only what species look like, but what that individual's appearance could actually be. So my question is, are your sculptures peer-reviewed by other artists and or scientists, or are the likenesses just a personal best guess?
My sculptures are often reviewed when they're in progress by scientists, but they're, honestly speaking, there are no other artists that take it to this level. I mean, the other artists that are my main competitors, one pair went to art school and one woman came from film school. They can do fantastic art and they use some anatomical stuff. I mean, I've seen pictures of their progress occasionally, but I think they're not, I don't know how to say this tactfully. Oh,
well, you're the only one doing this then.
Well, taking it to this level. I mean, nobody has done 5 adult gorilla dissections and 20 bonobo and chimp dissections and, you know, an equal number of humans and all that kind of stuff.
I was able to visit you there at the Paleontological Research Institution where you're the artist in residence. And I came into your studio and I was just simply stunned. John, I was in awe, of course, but there were casts, there were skeletons, there were, I don't know,
bones
if there actually
faces
were,
everywhere.
But you take, so when you talk about your process of reconstructing our ancient human relatives, our ancestors, you are exactly measuring muscle attachments. You have studied every living ape and attachment points.
Well, it's forensic pathology is what it is.
It is forensic. You're bringing the dead back to life as carefully and as scientifically as you can. But then there's a point, too, where you do, and I think that's what Dave was alluding to.
Well, yeah, you have to put in expression. You have to put in, if the eyes are not correct, it looks, that lazy eye makes a sculpture look dead. And if the eyes aren't the proper placement in the skull and around the eyelids, I know because I built puppets,
The sculpture looks dead, and your sculptures look alive, like it's a photograph, even though they're 3D.
I spend a week on that.
You are giving the sculpture that you've done a soul, a personality.
Yeah.
And so we can make an emotional connection with it as a viewer. You look
right
at this face and you resonate with it.
I'm glad it strikes you that way. That is super important. And that is strictly the province of the artist. It's got, I mean, the size of the eyeballs and all that, and their position in the eye sockets and all that, that's based on scientific information. But making this soul that looks back at you, there has to be a presence there. And if you don't succeed in that, you might as well not have done the whole rest of the face. If you can't make it live in the eyes. And so I spend a week just setting the eyes and looking at them and going out and getting a fresh look the next morning. And, oh, that needs to come in a little bit and so forth.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I know that.
That's
exactly
so important.
Do you use orange peel for skin texture as they do in the special effects? How do you get all the pores?
I use casts of humans for that.
And really? Oh.
Also casts of ape faces, and I make latex peels from those.
And you stipple it?
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah.
And my other question about these sculptures in the Smithsonian, how do you choose something that's going to have 10, 20, 50 years longevity? What are the materials that you use for longevity?
Basically, I use silicone, a type of silicone that can be tinted any color and made any luster and also have any degree of translucence, so I can control all that. This is a silicone that lasts over time and is resistant to heat and stuff like that. So the eyeballs are acrylic eyes. I used to make them myself. I made all the Smithsonian figures with my own eyes, but I found some really good eyeball makers. It saves me a lot of headaches. It's an intensive process, and only about half of them come out, at least with my level of skill. So I used to make my own eyeballs and you know, half of them wouldn't work out and they'd go in the Halloween box.
Yeah. And you have to have the capillaries too, right on the sides of the eyes. Yeah, it's an incredible process.
You have to make one part and then fuse that onto the next part and then fuse the next part onto that. And each step has to work perfectly or you have to throw it out.
So with a lot of our human ancestors, they're hairy. Hair all over them. And I remember reading somewhere that you use black bear hair for...
That's right. For the more primitive ones, I do.
Ray said you had a Lucy that melted once because you used wrong...
Okay, this is getting back to materials. I had a fork in the road at one point.
Yeah.
And I could have either gone with silicone or I could have gone with soft urethane. I did some tests with silicone and it kept sticking to the mold. And I thought, okay, I better use urethane. Big mistake. So I made a Lucy figure for the Denver Museum of Nature and Science.
And Lucy is the iconic leaky Australopithecus.
Yeah, it's not a leaky find.
Oh.
It was discovered by Don Johansson and his team.
Well, thank you for the clarification.
Oh, sure.
Why did I assume leaky was part of Lucy?
Well, because Lucy's the most famous fossil and Leakey's the most famous fossil hunter. I've talked to other people who have made that same mistake. But anyway, Lucy is an iconic fossil. She lived about 3.2 million years ago. She's an Australopithecus, and it was the first time that we had found anything like a fairly complete skeleton of an Australopith. So we could determine all of a sudden their body proportions, and that was a big deal. We could be fairly confident about building an outline of her body. And so really, this is the first time a really early hominin could be reconstructed. And the reason I use black bear hair is because this needs to look like fur, possibly like great ape fur. That would be our nearest guess. But, you know, we don't know for sure. But this, it needs to look like fur, and cut human hair does not look like fur.
Hmm.
If you punch in bear hair with tapered ends, you can really get it to look like fur. We don't know how much body hair Lucy had. I mean, her ape ancestors presumably had a full coat of body hair like all of the apes we know about. And we also know that at the 2 million mark, humans probably lost their coat of body hair. And that's because at that point, we became adapted as a long-distance traveler, both endurance running and long-distance walking. We were out there in the open in many cases. We needed to sweat. Well, sweat the enhanced sweat gland cooling system that humans use to cool themselves does not work with a full coat of hair.
Oh, so it's a trade-off. So, you know, the less hair you have, the better you can adapt it to heat.
Yep. So the consensus is that humans lost their body hair. We don't know how hairy the critters in between were, let's say the australopiths. I've just completed a Lucy figure for the Institute of Human Origins. She has a coat of body hair that's somewhere between. It's not as thick as, let's say, a chimpanzee, but it's certainly not as sparse as a human.
With the black bear hair, how many hairs do you put into a figure like Lucy?
Almost all of them are done one at a time. In really thickly haired areas like back of the head, you can get away with groups. But I tried to figure this out, and I came up with somewhere between 200,000 and 500,000 individual hairs.
So, wow, my God. So are
and is that you, or is that you and
yeah,
your team?
Contract? Yeah. You bring in your teenage friends or something? Or
actually, I have done that. Yeah. In fact, there was one time when I found an artist in town who could actually do that and make it look good. And wow. So there was a time when I went on a vacation, a family vacation in Florida, while he was back here in the freezing Shermansburg, New York, while the snow fell down, punching hair one at a time. So I occasionally thought of him while I was playing with my kids in the sea.
Wow.
Back there. With the wind whipping around the corners of my studio, punching hairs one at a time.
I have an anatomical question.
Yeah.
Why does Homo heidelbergensis, or gensis, or gensis? How do you pronounce it?
Hard G.
Okay.
Heidelbergensis.
Why does Homo heidelbergensis have that massive brow ridge compared to all of our hominin ancestors? Is there any morphology as to the reason why it has that prominent jutting out?
Yeah, there are a number of ancestors that have big brow ridges, but I think you're right. I think the biggest ones are found on some of the Homo heidelbergensis skulls. There have been a number of theories that have been put forward for what that's all about. One of them was basically just bizarre development in the history of life on Earth.
Headbutting?
What's that?
For headbutting. No.
No.
Bar fights.
When the front of the mouth is used as a clamp, so they're gripping things with their front teeth, or they're straightening spears with their front teeth, or whatever they're doing, using their teeth as a clamp, that generates a lot of force that it might bend the skull a bit. And so to resist those sort of bending forces, the brow ridge is thought to absorb some of that force.
Is there dentition wear to show that they were using their teeth for clamping stone tools?
Yes.
Or wood?
Yep.
There is. Oh.
Yeah. That shows that they were using their front teeth in unusual ways. We can't always tell what it is. Some of it looks like the wear on modern populations that process skins with their teeth.
Right.
And,
you mean chewing leather or holding leather skin?
Either one. And I'm speaking of front teeth, so I'm thinking more of holding it as a clamp. For example, if you hold a piece of leather in your teeth and then you want to make perforations, make holes in it, that might be a way of doing that.
And how many thousand years does this brow ridge appear and then vanish as a result of an evolutionary adaptation?
Homo erectus first appears at 2 million years ago. That's the oldest known Homo erectus material. There are early Homo skulls going back further, but they don't have the big brow ridges. Homo erectus is characterized by a fairly large brow ridge, and that goes all the way through to Homo heidelbergensis, and then later descendants like Neanderthals. They have fairly large brow ridges. And also this newly discovered critter known as the Harbin cranium. And there's a story behind that.
And what is that? What's a Harbin cranium?
Yeah, what's that?
The story that everybody knows about is enchanting enough. And that is that there was